All right, to the text. We're going to finish our study in Matthew chapter 8 today, and as we begin, I want to clarify one thing here. As far as salvation is concerned, it's a free gift. We understand that here. I know that for some, depending on their denominational affiliation or their theological upbringing, that may be a point of contention, but we do believe that Jesus saves and that it's a free gift taken by faith and believing in Christ, and that is the end of it. However, when you get saved, God puts His Holy Spirit inside of you and causes you to desire more than that. Salvation is a good gift, and we're content with the salvation He offers, but we want to follow Him. That's true of all believers. They want something more. They want to be close to Christ. They hunger and thirst for righteousness. I could go on and on with scriptures that indicate that there is more to Christianity than just saying a prayer and getting saved. And so this morning we're going to look at that and the trouble that they had back then in the first century with those coming to Christ for something really other than what salvation was guaranteeing. I actually want to back up into last week's text and cover verses 16 and 17 once more, where it tells us that evening had come, and they brought to Him many who were demon-possessed, and He cast out the spirits with a word and healed all who were sick, so that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, saying, He Himself took our infirmities and bore our sicknesses. And again, we praise God for the work that He's done apart from any goodness in us. He come to bear the weight of our problems, and Jesus did that in more ways than one, here physically, but also spiritually. Now, He's come down from the mountain. He has taught His Sermon on the Mount in chapters 5, 6, and 7. And now that He's come down from the mountain to an altitude that's a little more conducive to following Him with ease and comfort, we notice that the crowds have swelled. He's got a lot more followers now that He's not in such difficult places to reach. It's a little too strenuous to climb a mountain, and we're going to wait for Him to come back down. Now that He's down, the crowds have swelled again. We hadn't read about great multitudes since chapter 4 when He went up the mountain. Apparently, the crowd shrunk. Now that He's come back down, it's great multitudes again, and we see that here. I want you to look at verse 16 when it says that when evening had come, they brought to Him many who were demon-possessed and sick and all the rest. So the crowd has swelled, and then at evening, it swelled again. So the masses continue to increase. And I want to point out in verse 16 why that happened, because evening had come. It happened precisely at evening time, and when evening had come, they brought to Him all that were sick and demon-possessed and all the rest. Now, the reason that's significant is because it was happening on the Sabbath, and they had to wait until Sabbath was over. Sabbath ended at evening, and it wasn't until the ending of the Sabbath that it's because all kinds of Sabbath restrictions would have prevented them religiously from coming to Christ. There was lots of barriers that religion presents a person, both then and now, to coming to Christ with all sincerity. And one such barrier was the rules and regulations that they had built upon the Sabbath, and they would have been in violation had they come to Christ before the sun set. And it wasn't because Jesus was unwilling to heal on the Sabbath. There are plenty of texts in the Gospels to prove otherwise. He did heal on the Sabbath. The reason they didn't come to Christ at that time was because they were unwilling to be healed on the Sabbath. That's rather disappointing. But these are people that you may encounter from time to time if you're in the Christian circle that want all the blessing and benefit of an encounter with Christ as long as it fits in with their schedule, right? Like I can't be there, I can't make it during the day, but my calendar's open in the evening. And so we're going to have to work you in, Jesus, where we can, all right? So we'll catch up with you when it fits. But until then, our relationship is on hold. And it's interesting to me because back then, they had one day a week that Jesus didn't fit into. Many today can only fit Him in one day a week. For them, Saturdays were off. We're busy, we got things scheduled, social expectations, religious obligations, one day a week, any other day of the week, Jesus, we'd be glad to meet with you. For many Americans in 2022, they can only find the time to give Jesus one day a week. Monday they're busy, and Tuesday they're busy, and Wednesday and Thursday and Friday. Saturdays we're busy, and I can usually make it to church, but sometimes, you know, I'm just busy. And so Jesus, then like now, is neglected for reasons of scheduling. These are people who might be desperate for Jesus' help. They were, but they weren't that desperate. It's interesting also because if you look at this for what it is, it's pretty clear that there are some people, at least in this text, that would rather prolong their own torment, right? Their own blindness, their own paralysis, than to let God intervene with their schedule, right? I know I'm demon-possessed, but I just doesn't work right now. So I'm going to just have to wait until... Really? It's insane that people would play that game. Yet, welcome to America. We just don't have time for our beloved Savior. I can't follow you now. It doesn't work for me. Now, I got to ask you if this is you. Jesus is doing so little work in your life because you give him such a small window of opportunity through which to work. Huh? Jesus, you're only accessible to him on certain days of the week or certain times of the day or when you're within a certain circle of friends. Like at church, that's fine, but not when I'm, you know, Saturday night. Or maybe you're in a certain frame of mind. You only come to Christ when you feel like worshiping. You got to ask yourself whether that's you. Is your relationship with Jesus conditional? Because for a lot of people it is, and the Bible exposes them. How much access to your life have you given to Christ? Are there places that he doesn't get to go? Areas that you won't allow him to touch? Like, I want help over here. I want help with the sickness, the paralysis, the blindness, the demon possession. You know, they come to him and they categorize. We want your help with these issues, but leave us alone about these issues. And people do that plenty. I met lots who want Jesus to help them with a certain, perhaps, addiction or perhaps a certain financial mishandling, you know. But they want him to keep out of their daily routine. I'll decide the rest. I'll decide where I work. I'll decide what I do. But I just want you to make my life a little bit easier in this category. Or I want you to help me. I'm an addict. I need help. So take away the cravings, but stay out of my sexual life. That's none of your business, Jesus Christ, creator of the universe. What's mine is mine. The extent to which we let Jesus into our lives determines just how far we will go with him in this life, if he lets us go with him anywhere at all. Because following him, there are stipulations. Salvation is a free gift. Following Jesus, and we know this to some extent, and perhaps this is news to a few of you, but following Christ will cost you everything. And so now we're going to be introduced to a couple of individuals, and then a whole bunch more after that, who are interested in a little bit of Jesus, but the majority of them will go no further with him than an initial blessing. Just a superficial, initial, temporary healing, which, by the way, they were temporarily healed. They would all eventually die, right? So it was just a Band-Aid on the wound of a sinful condition. And Jesus was only allowed so far in. The first one we read about, well, first, before we even read them, look at what verse 18 says, that when Jesus saw these great multitudes, he gave a command to depart to the other side. To clarify, he's commanding his disciples to get into boats and go, and now he is going to leave the multitudes behind. Now, this is really a detail about Jesus that would be easy to breeze through because it's just one short little snippet in one tiny little verse tucked away into one of the four Gospels, right? So, But Jesus, and this isn't the first time. It happened in chapter 5, verse 1. That's why he went up the mountain. He saw the multitudes, and he blows up the mountain. And then when his disciples came to him, then he sat down to teach. And here now he's seeing the multitudes again. And he's like, guys, get in a boat. We're leaving. Is this really the Jesus that we know and love? Like, what? Okay. He would do this to some people, but would he do that to me? Would Jesus do that to you and I? Does he actually treat people like this? Well, it depends on how much access you give him into your life. If you only want him to interfere with certain parts, then guys, you only get to interfere with certain parts of his. Sure, he'll bless you. He'll meet up with you on Sundays. You can come to church and worship Jesus. Great, you meet him here. A lot of people say, I like that church. I meet Jesus there. I want to come where I want to come to the church. I need a meeting with Jesus. That's sad. You're supposed to take Jesus home with you. You're supposed to go wherever Jesus goes. You're not just have meetings like schedule him in. Again, you're to live life with Christ. That means following him. And those who only give Jesus a limited access may be blessed with his healing. He may bless you in certain areas of your life, but he will never bless you with his abiding presence. And that's what we want from Jesus. That's what our soul craves, his abiding presence. Instead, what he does here, he departs. He leaves. And the sad truth is, most people are okay with that. They don't want Jesus in their life all the time. Good grief. He's trouble. Like, right? We've studied the Bible here long enough to know how this goes. Jesus is going to put them all in hot water. We aren't even going to get out of today's text before they're in, like, not hot water, but, like, really turbulent wave, you know, like, we're going to drown and die water. Following Jesus ain't fun. And so a lot of people, like many, like the multitudes, really, Christians, generally speaking, want Jesus to bless them from time to time, but then want him to go away. This is how many, many will live their life. Even those who say they want to be close to Jesus, even those who say they will pay the price to follow him, don't always want to as much as they thought at first. Once they start to realize what the implications are and what the stipulation or what the requirements are, that's when all bets are off. Let's meet one of them in verse 19. A certain scribe came and said to Jesus, "Teacher, I'll follow you. I will follow you wherever you go." And Jesus said to him, I'm going to read a little tone into this, okay? Just because I believe I know what the tone was. Dude, foxes have holes. Birds of the air have nests. But the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. The Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. I'll follow you wherever you go. Really? Do you know what you're signing up for? Have you talked to anybody who's followed me already? Have you studied the Old Testament? Do you know where this path is going? Bold claims right out the gate. No sooner has this man introduced himself and he wants full inclusion into the discipleship community because he is oh so ready to join the discipleship community and he has what it takes to join the discipleship community. And Jesus doesn't say no and he doesn't say yes. He just goes, you might want to know what you're getting into because a lot of people are ignorant. Right? Well, I'm going to get into this, and I know exactly what Christianity is going to be because I was taught in Sunday school that it all goes well and that my problems in life stem from not following Jesus. And so if I follow Jesus, the problems go away. No, the problems increase. If you follow Jesus, you're actually trading away a few of the problems that were caused by your sin and rebellion. You're trading those away for new problems that are unique to those that come to because you follow Christ now. So it doesn't get easier. If anything, it gets more difficult in a unique kind of way. So this man insists that he's going to follow Jesus anywhere, and Jesus doesn't take him at his word. And here's why. I believe it's because the man is entirely self-willed. If you notice, he comes saying, and these are his words, he comes saying, "Teacher, I will." Look at your Bible. "Teacher, I will. I will. I got this. I am self-willed, I am self-determined, I am self-motivated. Look, the guy was never called. Jesus never said, hey, come and follow me. Jesus never found him fishing and said, leave your nets, come with me. He was not invited. He's inviting himself. Didn't need to wait for an invitation because this guy thinks that he's got it all. Jesus would be lucky to have me on his team. And so he invites himself in, says, I'll follow you wherever you go. And I'll bet, now I've been in ministry long enough to know how this kind of goes. I'm guessing that the man sort of had this over-the-top pride that thought that he'd be doing Jesus a favor by being on his team, and that Jesus would have responded with a, oh, thank you so much. That is so good. I'm so glad that you're here. We could use your help. Listen, I need you to do this and that, and we're going to give you a really high position where there's a lot of glory and a lot of praise because we need your kind. He was a scribe, after all. Scribes and their society, they were kind of up there. They make the rules. They tell people how to live. And he comes saying, Jesus, I'm going to give you my services. I will follow you wherever you go. And Jesus goes, no, you won't. Didn't let the man get very far at all without confronting him with the hard demands of real discipleship. I think some people will take a step or two in this direction only to find out that, uh-oh, this is maybe not what I wanted. This isn't certainly what wasn't what I thought it was. It's actually a little offensive. I would dare say that this man's ego was wounded. They realize that they're not going to get a lot of praise, if any at all. If you read through the Gospels, you'll find that there is something interestingly absent from Jesus' vocabulary. He never says thank you, except to God. Never. I don't know about you, but Jesus has never thanked me. Oh, Justin, thank you. That was an awesome sermon. I don't get pats on the head. I don't get slaps on the back. Attaboy, you know. So if you're looking to follow Jesus for lots of congratulations and thank yous, that's not the way it's supposed to go. And by the way, Jesus isn't here anymore, and so the church has stepped into that role now. Jesus commissioned his disciples to go and disciple others. Jesus didn't stick around to keep making more and more disciples throughout the centuries. He left it to the church, and the church now is to do that. So if you come here and go, well, Justin's kind of a jerk. He never says thank you. He's so demanding. He just, I mean, geez, listen to the way he preaches. That's Jesus-style ministry. I don't know what we're being spoon-fed out there, or bottle-fed, even worse, but it isn't biblical. And so you think, you just go to any church, and they're glad to have you. Most of them would be. I've said this before, I've got a discipleship community in this church, and any church in this community would be glad to have you on their team. I guarantee you that. I guarantee you that. So if you don't feel like you're getting pats on the back and you need that, door's open. You'll get it out there. But Jesus doesn't provide that. You look at what he's doing for these guys right off the bat. This guy isn't even a disciple yet. He's still a scribe. Hasn't quit his job yet. Hasn't left everything to follow Christ. He ain't in. Catch up with me when you quit your job. Catch up with me when you leave your family like these other guys did. Catch up with me when you're ready to run with the horses, footman. Well, then I don't know if I really want this. I don't know if I can handle this. And by the way, there were many who did get into the discipleship community who ended up leaving Jesus along the way because they were offended in time. John chapter 6 says, many left him and walked with him no more. And the reason is because Jesus, to them, started to look a little bit crazy, started to look a little bit arrogant, started to be a little bit too demanding. You know, eat my flesh and drink my blood. What is that? See, I always knew this guy. There's something wrong with this guy. And I've known it for a while now. I'm leaving. I'm done. We've seen it time and time again in Scripture as well as in real life. Jesus never, ever bribed anybody into following him. Never. Never does he hold out fleshly incentives like a carrot treating you like a donkey. He wouldn't do that to you. He doesn't hold out fleshly incentives because there are none. Your flesh is going to kick and scream. And you're not following Christ unless that your flesh is just wailing. I hate this. This is awful. I can't do it. Yeah, there you go. That's awesome. That's awesome because my discipleship, that's us. Our flesh hates this. And Jesus, he never promised comfort. He promised discomfort. That was his promise. He never promised glory. He never promised thanks. He never promised praise. What he does hold out for us, he has a terrible advertising campaign. His advertisements, you know, I mean, we got to really change our posters, right? Because he advertised the fact that it required self-sacrifice and self-denial and self-mortification. I'm surprised he got anybody to sign up at all. Sometimes I'm surprised we got anybody coming to church here at all. The demands are high. In verse 21, somebody else, another of his disciples here, comes and says, "Lord, let me first go and bury my father." Again, a schedule conflict. I got a funeral this weekend. You know, it's a family thing, Jesus, and your family first, right? And Jesus clarifies, "No, I'm not family first. Just so you know, I'm Christ first. I'm kingdom first. I'm God first. Look at my life. I put God first. Where's my ma? Where's Mary? Where's my brothers? They're all outside. They all think I'm crazy. It's God first." And so Jesus says, "No, follow me and let the dead bury their dead. Follow me, let the dead bury their dead." If you look at the words this guy is using, he's just as guilty as the first guy was. Different words, but same problems. The scribe came saying, "I will," right? Self-motivated man, "I will." This disciple comes saying, look at your text here in verse 21, "Lord, me first." Those words should never go together, by the way. Lord, Master, me first, let me first. And Jesus says, "No." And so here comes somebody, and he is a disciple, by the way. This is one of Christ's disciples, we're told. And he says, "Me first." He's got a me first attitude. No regard for anybody else in the discipleship community, what his absence would mean for them. No consideration for how his absence is affecting the group. He wants to follow Jesus insofar as it doesn't interfere with his personal life. And you could almost, it's hard to blame the guy. This is a family funeral, and it's not like a second cousin. You know, "Oh, my dog died." It's my dad. And Jesus goes, "Yeah, but there's more important things than going to your dad's funeral, and I'll let you in on a little secret. Even your dad knows that right now. Your dad doesn't want you to go to his funeral and skip out on kingdom work. Your dad, even if he's in hell, wants you right now to put God first. And he himself regrets that he doesn't have a chance to come back and tell you that personally." I'm going off of Luke 16. You can read it for yourself. Priorities. What are your priorities? And there comes a point for every disciple where your personal life collides with your church life. There will come a point for every true disciple, every genuine follower of Christ, where your personal life is going to collide with your church life, and that for you will be a defining moment, no less than it was for this guy. And just like the scribe before him, this disciple represents a lot of people in the greater church. A lot of people who assume that they can make minimum sacrifice to Jesus and still keep up with him, still be participatory in all the family things and all the community things and all the hobby things and all of the entertainment things and everything else that they had going before they volunteered themselves to follow Christ as a slave. And Jesus won't patronize. He won't do it. He won't do it. If that's you, you're not a disciple. He won't allow it. And by the way, if this guy goes to the funeral, he loses his spot as a disciple. He's no different than those in John 6 who walked away. A disciple no more. Jesus says, "Let the dead bury their dead." If that sounds weird, he's referring to those that are outside of the discipleship community who lack spiritual faith, the unsaved. Let the unsaved take care of that unimportant business. You've got something to do. I've commissioned you for kingdom work. If you want to go to the, again, Jesus doesn't tell him yes. Yeah, you can go to the funeral. And he doesn't tell him no either. It's up to you. But I advise that you let the dead bury their dead. Keep kingdom work your priority. And by the way, I don't think Jesus was telling this guy anything that he didn't already know. There's a reason why he came up to Jesus asking. It was already bothering his conscience. The fact that he's asking says he already had a feeling it was wrong to go. But even after receiving Jesus' counsel, he had a choice to make. And now this guy could have done what a lot of other people do. I've seen this time and time again. And it's this. They get a no from Jesus, or everything but a no, and they reject the counsel they've received. And to assuage the guilt that comes for doing what they know they're not supposed to, this man, attending a family gathering, he goes to the family gathering anyway under the promises of, oh, I'm going to witness. I'm going to witness there. You said it yourself, Jesus, they're not saved. They need me there. I need to be a light to them. And that all sounds well, and maybe it sounds legit to you. But what we're missing here is that Jesus told him to do otherwise. Don't go. I don't need you to be a light in their life by going there. I need you to be a light in their life by not going there. That's the message your family needs. That you're too busy with kingdom work to fuss around with worldly things. That's a witness. Last thing his family needs is the example of another lukewarm Christian who compromises the will of God all the time. We got plenty of examples of that. You know what this church needs? You know what Christianity in America needs? You know what would shine like light in our country? And it wouldn't be hard to shine in this dark world. Put Jesus first. Cancel other stuff. Make it a priority. Be a church. Be where the discipleship community is. Do everything the team of Christ is doing. Onward, Christian soldier! He may be a disciple, but he's very immature. And if you notice, he does call Jesus Lord, but time will tell whether it's actually true. We don't know how things turned out. We don't know in the end if he went to the funeral or not. But if he did, I can guarantee you one thing. God didn't bless it. He went, and he probably tried to be a witness, and he probably tried to enjoy himself or be there to help people or do whatever it was that made him so compelled to go. But God didn't bless it. Didn't turn out like he had hoped. That's for sure. I don't know if I'm selling the opportunity for discipleship this morning. I don't know if anybody's, you know, yeah, I want that. But I will tell you very clearly that if you do want discipleship, if you want to follow Christ, and if it's kingdom first, then every one of us in here is going to have to get used to not going wherever and doing whatever we want anymore. We are all part of a team now. And for us here, this is the team. We're a community. We're a church. And everything that we do in our personal life affects this group. Everything. Everything. This man is coming to grips with that. No telling whether he ever accepted it. Moving forward now, Jesus, as you remember, commanded his disciples to cross the lake, and it seems as if they're attempting to escape the multitudes yet again. And when he got into a boat, verse 23, his disciples followed him. And suddenly a great tempest arose on the sea so that the boat was covered with the waves. This is an extraordinary weather system that has overtaken this little company of disciples. And we see at once some of what it looks like to follow Christ. Okay? The weather is interesting in that area. I'm told that the cool winds would sweep across the Mediterranean Sea and then up Mount Hermon, which is like 9,000 some feet high, and then it comes down over the other side and descends into the Sea of Galilee where these fishermen were, and that the descent is steep and it actually plummets hundreds of feet below sea level. So it's descending further than it ever ascended. And so she comes sweeping down the other side, the cool air, and the other side of Mount Hermon is riddled with gullies and ravines. So the cold air settles down into these ravines and just shoots out like a shotgun blast across the water. And you may not even have a cloudy day, if I'm not mistaken, and you'll be overtaken with a sudden violent storm. Now, these guys were seasoned fishermen on that same lake, so they were no strangers to these weather systems, these patterns. And yet this one was exceedingly fierce. This is a great tempest, so much so that they're afraid for their lives. They've seen weather like this before, and they've handled it just fine. This is nothing new. But this one is above and beyond anything that they've ever felt. Now, guys, and I'll tell you that's the way it is when you follow Christ. It will take you to places that are above and beyond anything you've felt by way of difficulty. Again, unique to those who follow Christ. The multitudes are still on shore. They're fine. They're fine there. It's the ones in the boat. And there Jesus is asleep. So his disciples came to him and awoke him, saying, "Lord, save us! We're perishing!" But he said to them, "Why are you fearful, O you of little faith?" And then he arose and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a great calm. So the men marveled, saying, "Who can this be that even the winds and the sea obey him?" This would have been such a sudden calming of the sea that it was nothing short of miraculous. It's interesting because if the wind stopped, like if only the wind had obeyed Jesus and instantly ceased, it would have taken a while for the sea to settle down, right? And you churn up that kind of volume of water, it ain't gonna just smooth as glass with the snap of a finger. But he rebuked both the wind and the waves, and both of them ceased immediately. Lucky these guys didn't fall out of a boat, right? They're at the top of a 20-foot wave, and then all of a sudden, they're like left in midair, you know, almost like a Looney Tunes thing. And down they go. And Jesus rebukes the wind and the waves, and they marvel. Another gospel account says that they were actually more afraid after that happened than they were when they were in the storm. Christian discipleship used to be life-threatening. I don't know what happened, but it seems today that it's a rather comfortable endeavor. A lot of discipleship seems to take place in a nice cafe, controlled temperature, and a pleasant conversation over coffee. That's discipleship, and then we pray together. And I encourage you and bless you. And I'm not saying that doesn't have a place in discipleship, but I'm just showing you the contrast, okay? This is first century discipleship. It was life-threatening. These guys were terrified, and they were convinced they were going to die. Now, to their credit, after Jesus rebukes their lack of faith, they might not have much faith, but they were where they were supposed to be. At least they had that. At least they were in a position where they could get rebuked. I think a lot of Christians are afraid to ever step up and step in because they don't want to get in trouble. They think too highly of themselves. They think they're awesome, and they would like to keep it that way. And to actually go down the road of discipleship means you're going to get corrected a lot. The nature of discipleship is one of discipline. And so you can't escape it. If you're going to follow Christ, he's going to get after you. He's going to be displeased with you sometimes. He's going to correct you because you're going to do it wrong. And if that's not true, then why is he treating these guys like that, but no one else? Disciples are disciples. He rebukes them, but at least they were in a position to be rebuked. And I'll tell you this, little did they realize it was safer in that boat, even in the middle of a storm, because they were in the will of God, than it ever would have been to be even in a brick house on shore. You leave the will of God, all bets are off. But if you're in the will of God, no matter how tumultuous your scenario is, you're safe. Believe it or not, you're safe. These guys had a hard time believing that, but we know, and Jesus knows, you're safe. He says, you of little faith, that's a bit of a rebuke that I think would have come as a shock and an insult to most disciples. Again, it's not easy on the ego to follow Christ. That's not a flattering experience at all. And these guys' lack of faith was publicly exposed. They were in company. It was in front of one another. And then it got recorded in the Bible for all of us to read. So these guys look like buffoons. It will publicly humiliate you. I'll tell you that discipleship isn't meant so that you can show the world how competent you always were and how lucky Jesus is to finally have you on his team. Discipleship is actually so that you can see how inept you actually are, because sometimes we overlook our faults. When a person accepts Christ's invitation to follow him, they're giving him access to the most vulnerable parts of who they are, their emotions. Jesus gets to your emotions, your self-esteem, your identity. And Jesus will, yes, he will, take advantage of every opportunity he can to reform you and make you more like himself. Moving forward in verse 28, it says that when he had come to the other side, to the country of the Gergesenes, there met him two demon-possessed men coming out of the tombs, exceedingly fierce, so that no one could pass that way. And suddenly they cried out, saying, "What have we to do with you, Jesus, you Son of God? Have you come here to torment us before the time?" Now, a good way off from them, there was a herd of many swine feeding. And this is telling, because in that area, there should have been no swine feeding. Pork were unclean, pigs were unclean. And yet we find out that this is a substantial herd of pigs, 2,000. And so they were keeping them, they were breeding them, they were pig farms. And so this is already a violation of the law, and reveals to us that there were great sins, great disregards for God's laws in that area. And so the demons begged him, saying, if you cast us out, permit us to go away into the herd of swine. And he said to them, go. And so when they had come out, they went into the herd of swine, and suddenly the whole herd of swine ran violently down the steep place into the sea and perished in the water. What a sight that would have been. I've never seen animals commit suicide like that before, but I can't imagine what it would be like to see a couple thousand just going to drown themselves on purpose. Very frightening. It frightened everybody, no doubt. Now, we've already been told in Matthew's gospel that Jesus had been exorcising demons in verse 16 and that there were many such cases. But it's interesting because Matthew, Mark, and Luke all record this scenario. So he's been recording a lot of, he's been healing, exorcising a lot of demons. But all of a sudden, this one comes up and we get all the details. And I have to wonder why that is. Maybe it was because of the degree to which the two men were possessed. These are two men, and then there are apparently some 2,000 demons inside of these men. And maybe that was significant, and it caught the attention of the gospel writers, and they thought, we need to record this one. Maybe it was because the men were so exceedingly fierce. That's the language that's used. These guys were extremely violent. Maybe it was because of the bizarre detail of the possessed pigs. You know, I mean, that was unique to this story. And so maybe it was these details that inspired these gospel writers to record this particular incident in such detail, but I don't believe it's just that. I actually believe, and because in all three accounts, it's preceded by the storm. Okay, so we read about Jesus calming the wind and the waves, and then we read about this demon in the tombs. It's the same order in Mark's gospel. It's the same order in Luke's gospel. And I think that the reason those two pair so well isn't just because they happen chronologically. I believe it's because in the first account, we learn that Jesus has power and authority over the natural world to calm waves and wind. And in this next account, we realize that Jesus has power and authority over the supernatural world, Very nice. Jesus has absolute authority in both the seen and the unseen universe. And so what does that mean to us? It shows us that it's absurd to think that Jesus doesn't get control over us. He has full power and full authority over every bit of this created world, and yet I'm going to hold out on him. I won't follow him. I will, but it's going to be on my terms. That does not make sense. We've already seen it. Some disciples reject Christ's authority. They just want to come and go as they please, when Jesus won't even let demons do that. These demons, 2,000 at once, they don't get to come and go as they please. People want to act however they want, do whatever comes natural to them. But wind doesn't even have that luxury. Wind has to obey Jesus, and yet he gives us the liberty to deny him, to follow him as loosely and as casually as we want. There's a high, high level of both arrogance and defiance that we see in the church today that cannot be found anywhere else in all of God's creation. Demons have to obey. Nature has to obey, but he leaves us disciples with a choice. He lets you choose the extent to which you'll obey him. He lets you choose. He could make you do it, but he won't. It says in verse 33 that those who kept the pigs fled, and they went away into the city and told everything, including what had happened to the demon-possessed men. And behold, the whole city came out to meet Jesus, and when they saw him, they begged him to depart from their region. Once people realize the price that is involved in accommodating Jesus, most people are going to distance themselves from him. Whether he chooses to leave them, like he did for the first two cases, or they choose to send him away, most people, believe me, will opt to keep Jesus at bay. They would rather not be close to Jesus at all once they realize what it costs to have him around. And a lot of Jesus' ministry was spent helping people realize this for themselves. Do you want Jesus in your life? We'll find out. We'll find out. And I'll tell you, there's probably plenty within earshot right now, TV, radio, wherever this message will find itself, there are people right now who don't want the biblical Jesus that I'm preaching. They don't want this version of discipleship. They're already turned off by the words. Well, glad I could turn you away now, because you don't want to get any further closer to Christ before it gets really bad. So today's the day that we decide. This is a defining moment. You choose. The choice is yours. And it's easy to think that we want to follow Jesus at first, and maybe some of you, you've been living your whole life like that. Yes, I want to be a follower of Jesus. And it's been really, really easy because you've got a very unbiblical version of Christianity. And we think we want to follow him at first, only to reverse our decision later on. And the nice thing about America and the nice thing about Duluth is that there's 100-some churches. And if this version of discipleship doesn't suit your fancy, you can go to a different one and make yourself believe that you're doing it right, when really you've left the will of God for something easy, just like the first guy did and just like the second guy did. And here we read about a whole city full of people who don't want the true Jesus in their life. I beg you, go away and let somebody else who's got a way easier go on Christianity plant a church here. We don't want Pastor Jesus. We don't want that ministry. We don't want him around. So, why should we follow him? Why say no to ourselves when everybody else gets to say yes? Everybody else gets to go to family events, funerals, right? Everybody else gets to live like they still get to do as they want, come and go as they please. Why would I pick up my cross and follow Jesus? I mean, leave me alone. I've already picked up my cross theoretically. Isn't that enough? In Luke 14, Jesus told his disciples to count the cost. And a lot of us were familiar with that. And a lot of us have done that. We've counted the cost. Part of what it means to count the cost is to be exposed to what the cost is. That's what you're getting today. You're realizing what the cost is. count it. And maybe some of you, you have counted the cost. And that's fine. You can do that all your life. But it does you little good if you never get around to paying the price. There's no ownership. You have no discipleship if all you're doing is looking at the price tag and deciding if you want to foot the bill. Jesus is ready for you when you're ready to pay the price. And the price is steep. It's too steep for the two men we met at the beginning on the other side of the Sea of Galilee, too steep for a whole city full of people on this side of the lake. And I'll tell you that if those who are willing to actually step up and pay the price to follow Christ in the first century were as scarce as we see them to be, then what does that suggest about the church in the 21st century? Jesus said, "When I return, will I even find faith on the earth?" So it's not getting better as we go. It's getting worse. And they weren't even off to a good start. Now, in closing, you might expect that I end the message by telling you of all the wonderful realities of following Jesus. And there are wonderful realities. There are incentives, there are benefits, but Jesus didn't do that. He wasn't looking for people to follow him because he promised a hope and a future, a restored body, better relationships, a lighter heart, a breathe easy life. He didn't hold out cheap incentives like that. He was actually trying to get away from people like that. Isn't that crazy? Jesus is looking for people who will follow him in spite of the fact that what he does promise is hardship, sleepless nights, family tension, pain, near-death experiences. He's looking for people who will follow him into life-threatening situations, let him ruin their earthly livelihood, take away their pigs, so to speak, people who can handle being rebuked for their failures publicly nonetheless. Would you let him do that? That's the bottom line. Will you let Jesus do that for you? Are you willing to pay the price for a once-in-a-lifetime shot at following Jesus Christ? Once in a lifetime, you get to pick. You can pick an easier life for yourself, or you can pick a biblical one. In America, we are oh so tempted to choose the former. But Jesus holds out for you what he held out for them. Do you want to follow me? I have no pillow. I have no place to lay my head. I don't go to funerals. I don't go to family stuff. I am single-minded. I am kingdom first. Do you want to follow me? Do you want to be a disciple? And I ask you this morning, if you were in their shoes, and maybe you are, faced with this kind of a decision, what would be your next move? Father, we come before you this morning acknowledging the fact that this is difficult, and I hope it is, because if it's not, then I haven't done justice to the text. Your truth, as you presented it in the way that you did, turned away so many people. And we have got to hold the course as a church if we expect to be light for anybody in this community. There are some, no doubt, that hold the course and preach the truth and invite people to first century discipleship, but I know for a fact that we are outnumbered by those who don't hold the line and make it easy and offer a cheap 21st century version of discipleship. So because I love people, I want to be a church that promotes the truth, shines like actual light, so that we aren't aiding and abetting the deception that people are under. You wouldn't do that. You introduced people to discipleship as it really, really was, and you suffered great loss for it. Many, many turned away from you. But Lord, I want to acknowledge the fact that you have given this church faithful men and women who do endure. And they do take the knocks. And they do absorb the pain. And I'm right there with them. I'm in that boat too. I'm just thankful I'm not alone. Fill our boats with others, Lord. Help us as a church to find those who will take you at your word and follow you regardless of the cost. We'll be glad we did. We'll be glad we did. Let's all stand.